Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the relationship between how science gets paid for and how science gets done? As research funders look to make prudent investments, big-name institutions can look like a safe bet, while smaller, more nimble labs lose out. And as money and power get concentrated, the aims of scientists can actually shift from major breakthroughs to incremental but reliable short-term progress. My guest worries that too much caution in science reduces opportunities for revolutionary innovation, and she has ideas for re-energizing research. Roberta B. Ness is dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health and vice president for innovation at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Her new book is called The Creativity Crisis: Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. Roberta, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We hear so often about the remarkable pace of scientific advancement that most of us don't think to question the conventional wisdom. For those with an inside view, can you talk about how you have witnessed a slowdown and what that looks like?
Yes, thanks. Science, I think, is almost universally considered to be the engine of societal progress in the modern age. And so it's absolutely critical that we, you know, kind of keep that engine going at full speed. What I argue is that some of the greatest threats to mankind, be it global warming, be it or climate change, be it emerging infections such as Ebola and others, be it Alzheimer's disease, cancer, these are huge threats, problems to the Earth and all of its inhabitants that science has been very, very slow to conquer, to really find solutions to. And I think that's for lack of not evolutionary but revolutionary innovation. And what I have seen in the last at least decade is this trend towards the safe, the simple, the linear, the stepwise, what we call evolutionary innovation, you know, making little, small steps rather than taking huge leaps, really making radical shifts that are often disruptive. That is highly feared, I think, increasingly feared within the scientific community writ large. That is to say, there is simply too much caution in the system.
And one consequence of that is that instead of searching far and wide for answers, we end up with a huge percentage of experts taking the same narrow perspective on things, maybe missing answers that lie elsewhere. Can you talk about how that would affect research on a problem like, say, obesity?
Absolutely. You're exactly right. I think it results in two things. One is a trend toward invention over discovery. That is to say, we have lots and lots of fantastic gizmos and gadgets, which is why we all think that science is just rocketing forward. Technology really is, science less so, obesity being a prime example. So scientists have watched over the last generation as obesity has really overtaken the United States and is now overtaking the rest of the world. In the United States today, the rates of overweight and obesity are two-thirds of the entire adult public. A third of the entire public is obese. So it's a huge problem. And the way that we have tried to conquer it over that entire period of time is really taking a very individualized diet and physical activity perspective. So it's really the notion of behavioral change around energy expenditure. We've had trial after trial after trial after trial after trial, dozens and dozens, that have essentially shown the same thing, which is, in fact, you can get people to lose weight. Unfortunately, they regain it. And particularly in the obese population, which is the group of individuals most in need, we have had virtually no success in getting people to lose sizable amounts of weight and sustain that weight loss. So alternative notions that are starting to pop up that are much more radical are really strange ideas like maybe there's a virus involved. Maybe obesity to some degree is a contagious disease. There is actually some data that suggests both of those radical ideas. Certainly the idea that one's own microecology in the GI tract relates to obesity. There's increasing data to support that. The notion that economically there are a limited number of food manufacturers that manufacture the processed foods that are dominantly responsible for almost all of the excess caloric consumption in the current American diet. You know, and maybe we should be thinking about those big food manufacturers in the same way that we think about the tobacco industry. So very, very different, completely paradigm-shifting ideas that are really being pursued only marginally in many cases.
How did you come to recognize that a lot of young scientists are getting the message that true innovation is a career killer?
Right. So this was very personal. I have been working on questions of innovation for the last half dozen years. The book, The Creativity Crisis, is the fourth book in a series on innovation. And my first book, Innovation Generation, was really about how to teach people a systematic method to think very differently, very radically, very innovatively. So it's really kind of a how-to book on creative thinking. And I've been happy to say that most of the major American universities in the country have invited me at one time or another to come out and give a talk about this, grand rounds, visiting professorships and such. And in so many of those conversations, at the end of the question and answer period, a young person would raise their hand from the back of the room, get up and say, you know, Dr. Ness, I mean, something almost exactly like this. Dr. Ness, this was inspirational, and I would love to be able to do this and think this way and work this way, but if I did, it would destroy my career. I would never be able to get funded.
And they say that because they've seen it in practice, particularly those who are working within the confines of large, in many cases, large academic institutions that are pretty hierarchical.
There is no question about that. Federal funding mechanisms tend to be quite conservative. I like to say that when scientists begin pointing the finger about, oh, well, that's the fault of government. That's really an error. The enemy is us. Scientists sit on the review committees, the advisory committees that make decisions about federal funding. And we tend to be, particularly in times of economic recession, which science is still in, we tend to be exceedingly conservative, exceedingly cautious. So those really high-risk proposals are simply not being funded. The other thing to say, as you mentioned, in terms of kind of the sociology of science, the hierarchy, the insularity, the people who sit on study section are typically senior. They typically have ideas to defend. And there are true turf issues around doing something that could potentially disrupt everything that came before, that could potentially define their crowning achievements as being erroneous.
I have to imagine that senior-level scientists are not thinking of themselves as sort of hunched over their work, elbowing everybody else out of the way. So how do scientists justify to themselves and to their colleagues this approach that basically makes very little room at the table for up-and-comers who might have different ideas?
That's a beautiful question. And the answer to that, I believe strongly, are true cognitive biases. It's not, you're right, I mean, it's not that senior scientists are purposefully creating barriers. It's that they absolutely and utterly believe in the paradigms, the frames that they are defending. When I teach about innovative thinking, when I teach people this method of thinking differently, one of the core concepts is this notion of frame shifting, of taking expectations, assumptions, and really being able to, you know, break them and find alternatives. That is extraordinarily difficult for people to do because those frames are highly embedded and they are notions that people truly have beliefs in. And the idea that they, you know, may be flawed or even entirely wrong is difficult for anyone to accept.
You mentioned a couple minutes ago that scientific research is still being affected by the recession, which technically was over a number of years ago. What accounts for the sort of lag time in scientific research recovering from the recession?
Well, the largest certainly source of biomedical funding in this country comes from the National Institutes of Health. And even this year, the very recently released budget from President Obama and then approved by Congress really allows for a fairly flat NIH budget. So NIH's budget has been either flat, well, it's been quite flat in the last number of years. And there is a phenomenon of scientific inflation, which actually has exceeded that of average inflation. And so what's happened is that the buying power that science has writ large has declined substantially. So what young people are seeing, well, what scientists are seeing in general, is funding rates from the NIH that are around 10%. So what does that mean? What that means is that good scientific proposals, you know, otherwise acceptable scientific proposals are going unfunded at a rate of 90%. Now, if you think about being involved in a field where your job may depend on external funding, particularly from the NIH, that's, you know, sounds like playing the lottery, right?
Yeah. Lots of people would say, well, just leave this to the markets and they will solve everything. But particularly for biomedical research, there's plenty of important stuff that doesn't make anybody much money.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the more radical the innovation, the less likely it is to make anybody money. Because so often these things are, in fact, conceptual. I'll give you one example. It's an old one, but it's a profound one. And that is the notion of germ theory. One has to recall that back in the before the mid-1800s, before Pasteur and Koch came on the scene, that we really had no idea from whence infection arose. And in fact, we had these strange notions of, you know, of things floating through the air and such. Germ theory is a notion that you could never patent. It doesn't belong to anyone, really, and yet it revolutionized the world.
We're speaking with Roberta B. Ness, Dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health and author of the new book, The Creativity Crisis, Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Roberta B. Ness, who is Vice President for Innovation at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston and author of the new book, The Creativity Crisis, Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Are scientific organizations refining their research goals to fit grant requirements?
Chris, we are always doing that. Scientists are opportunistic, fortunately opportunistic. Again, one has to go where the money is. As we've noted, where the money is really towards these incremental changes. But even more so, today, there is a trend towards what's been called translation. Now, I think that's very important. There's no question about that. In fact, I would hazard to say in this whole conversation that a cautionary perspective is far from crazy. I mean, there's a real reality base to that. It's just that caution has become too weighty against creation. But having said that, this kind of rush to translation comes all the way from Congress down. Congress started saying to the federal funding agencies, hey, what are you doing for us today? How are your findings being quickly translated into real clinical outcomes, real technological outcomes, real solutions? Obviously, that's very, very important. But again, when we look at the tremendous leaps in science and the ones that have the greatest downstream effect, they really tend to be very basic discoveries and observations and process and issues, rather than these very end of the pipeline kind of productions.
So you're arguing for the value of pure science, if not over applied science, at least it needs to have equal weight.
Yes, I am really arguing for a disciplined approach that would allow the public and federal funding agencies and scientists and policymakers to engage in a conversation that's really quite transparent in allowing funding for these various buckets in a way that makes more sense. At the moment, that conversation simply doesn't happen. I mean, the public has absolutely no idea. In fact, most scientists have absolutely no idea kind of what the orientation is of funding agencies.
How does the current climate, Roberta, discourage collaborative research across institutions and even across scientific disciplines?
Right. So the great innovation of our lifetime has clearly been the internet. And the web has afforded an opportunity to do something that has been called crowdsourcing. It's kind of openly democratic, pluralistic, large groups coming together to solve problems. Most often, it's done on a volunteer basis. It's an extraordinary activity. It's been shown over and over again to be highly creative, innovative. And science has been virtually barred from its participation, or scientists from their participation in crowdsourcing. Why? Because scientists gain credibility not from participating in innovative activities necessarily, but more in claiming the results of things. So if one gets a patent, if one is the first what's called the principal investigator on a grant, if one is the first author on a paper or the senior author on a paper, those are things that count with respect to the whole notion of credibility, which leads to promotion and tenure within academic institutions. Nothing else counts.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi, this is a wonderful program. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is that the doctor mentioned earlier how difficult it is for people to shift their frames of reference with regard to creativity. And I just completed a neuroscience course, and I've realized that we have these emotional attachments to our cognitive frameworks and our cultures, and science has a culture too. And I think the possible way to shift that frame of reference and stimulate creativity is to satisfy whatever emotional attachments people have to that framework in maybe a different way. That's my comment. My question is, I'm a senior, and I have an idea for a wind machine, and I'm just paranoid about it being stolen if I start to collaborate. And I was wondering whether the doctor might have any suggestions as to how I might get a patent on it, or at least one started, without spending a great deal of money, because I am on a fixed budget. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Hey, Bill, thanks for calling in. And that's a fantastic question, a very provocative set of comments. Just with respect to your first set of comments about frames, you're absolutely right. The thing that makes frames really sticky is that they're not just cognitive, they're emotional. It's not just that we have these, you know, kind of logical belief systems. We're strongly emotionally attached to our belief systems, and thereby getting people to kind of break away from that is not an easy task. That's the reason why, you know, I teach actually a very sophisticated method for doing that, frankly, and that there's kind of a whole book about it. But having said that, with respect to your specific question about the wind machine, that sounds really neat, and I would be terribly disappointed if you don't pursue it. So I hope you do. This exact issue of the kind of concern, I want to say almost paranoia, about idea ownership is exactly the kind of thing that, frankly, hampers creativity in the sciences. Kind of the patenting, the, you know, needing to get priority. Here's the thing. When you collaborate with respectable individuals, the chances of your losing an idea are much less than the chances of your gaining really important colleagues that can help you to not only bring your product to market, but in fact elaborate on, modify, benefit your idea so that it really becomes more important, more useful to the public. I'm really all about kind of the end product being beneficial to society. There is actually, frankly, some data that patenting from a societal perspective, not from your perspective, but from a societal perspective, that patenting interrupts the flow of ideas for exactly the reason that you're raising. Collaborate, and collaborate. That's my answer to you.
We don't necessarily put Henry Ford in the scientist box, but of course that's what he was in part. What allowed a titan like him to catalyze these extraordinary innovations in internal combustion engines and also in manufacturing techniques?
Right. So, Chris, Ford was obviously a consummate innovator on the technology side. And I think you can frankly argue that the breakthroughs that he made in so many areas around automotives, not just from an engineering perspective, but from a mass production perspective, from a sales perspective, he had a completely radical idea about selling these cars, that they should be essentially indestructible, that you should be able to go anywhere to get them fixed, just like you'd go to a hardware store to be able to find a wrench, that service should be perfect. All of those were just absolutely radical constructs in business and engineering and marketing and everything. How was he able to do it? In part, he was able to do it because he didn't get very kind of tied up in the whole notion of patenting, of ownership, of kind of keeping everything to himself. He was very uninterested in money. In fact, he was really highly cynical about the kind of American moneymakers and the kind of whole structure of industrialism. And so he just went about doing what he thought he needed to do. And it was so beneficial and so kind of useful to people that they bought it in huge numbers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phone now. We have Paul on the line in Kaufman. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Back when I was involved in research many years ago, we had some hurdles that we had to, that we could jump over, like that we absolutely positively could defend the species name that we thought we were working on for these biological systems, and that we had to make sure we paid homage to the statistical gods, okay, so that any research that we did could pass statistical muster. I'm wondering now, there have got to be new dogmas and new hurdles that the current researcher has to hurdle. For example, maybe the genetic characterization of these organisms. Could your author talk about some of those new hurdles?
Thanks for your call, Roberta.
Well, thanks for the question. There are, you know, always lots and lots of scientific hurdles to proving the validity of an idea, and that's a good thing. We shouldn't go off kind of half-cocked in science, because unlike in business, where you can have some weird and wild new idea and it can get very popular, and that's all, you know, well and good. Because it doesn't hurt anyone. In science, we can hurt people big time if we get it wrong. So there are certainly lots of hurdles to validity that should be there. But some of the things that probably shouldn't be there are, in addition, we've talked about some of the economics, we've talked about some of the social issues, but there's a third kind of whole realm, and that is in the ethical area. We have, as a society, become extraordinarily risk averse when it comes to kind of any kind of ethical breach. We simply go nuts, frankly, when a scientist kind of crosses an ethical line. And what has happened thereby is that science has become exceedingly regulated. And it's actually been estimated that 40% of a scientist's time is spent dealing with these rules and regulations that come from this strict regulatory environment. That is to say that only 60% of their time is actually spent on science, and that is just an inordinate waste of talent.
So ethics are important. It's important not to hurt anyone. And you give a really nuanced picture in the book, even in this sort of brief snapshot, of the career of Sidney Farber. Can you tell us a little bit about him? What he has to say to us today.
Absolutely. So Sidney Farber was the father of chemotherapy. Before he came along, cancer was an absolutely incurable disease. And Farber was an audacious guy who believed that he could really overcome that complete barrier to cancer remission and cure. He worked on childhood leukemia, and he came up with the first agent in a class called alkylating agents. The particular one was called methotrexate, that absolutely allowed children to go into remission for the first time ever. Now, Farber was an interesting guy in that he was bold and audacious. Those were good things because he was able to overcome so many hurdles to get to that point. But it was a bad thing with respect to the fact that he was willing to really kind of sacrifice the autonomy of some of his subjects. So now back in at this time, this was before IRBs came into the fore. It was before we had any of the ethical rules that we had. There was no process of kind of formal consent. But nonetheless, there were, I think, agreements or kind of expectations, assumptions that you would let people know what you were doing to them. And yet Farber enrolled families, children, into clinical trials really without telling them what any of the risks were. And in fact, early in the process of testing the drugs, he got it completely wrong. In fact, he went absolutely 180 degrees in the wrong direction, and he killed a number of children. Yet he continued on, undaunted, and then ultimately found the right answer. So, you know, it really is a question of kind of the risks versus benefits. I don't think anybody would agree that it's in any way acceptable to allow subjects to die. But at the same time, it does kind of give you, as you say, a nuanced sense of this double-edged sword.
IRB that you refer to is Institutional Review Board. These are organizations that sort of overlook at a broader, from a broader perspective, the ethics of science?
That's correct. Each institution, every one of the hospitals, every one of the medical centers in your area has an Institutional Review Board. It's a local board. It is then overseen by a national committee, but they make decisions about whether the science done at that institution is ethically acceptable or not.
My guest is Roberta B. Ness, Dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health and Vice President for Innovation at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Her new book is called The Creativity Crisis, Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Roberta B. Ness, Dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health and author of the new book, The Creativity Crisis, Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Greg who says, even though science is largely an epistemological enterprise and software development is an engineering one, could science learn something from the wildly successful open source movement where the idea of patenting ideas is discouraged? What would science look like if it were open source?
Yeah, Chris, thanks. Great question. I think that's critical, in fact. So there is a fascinating experiment that's been done, which has really gone just that route. It's called ADNI. It's basically an Alzheimer's disease consortium. What happened was that the federal government and industry got together and they said, you know, we've got this terrible disease. It's costing hundreds of billions of dollars per year, destroying people's lives, families' lives, and we are getting nowhere. We have no diagnostics. We have no therapeutic tools. We're just losing this war. What can we do to really kind of jumpstart innovation in this area? And so they put together a multi-million dollar fund, and access to the fund is only possible if the investigator agrees to immediate open source access to their results, and also to not patenting anything that basically comes out of this. They can subsequently license it, but they can't patent it. And so, what happened was that within a half a dozen years, suddenly out of this consortium came two major diagnostic breakthroughs that had never been possible before because people simply hadn't been communicating before. Now you had this large group of individuals working through open source together, very, very powerful kind of, I think, example of what can happen. I can give you lots and lots of other examples of how this is starting to evolve, but that really is, I think, the future of science.
What does all this suggest about science education? I was really disturbed to read the research that you have in the book about the collective creativity of American students today in general. It seems to be declining.
It is declining, unfortunately. There is evidence thereof. So there was, in fact, the name, the Creativity Crisis, was plucked from a Newsweek article that came out in 2010 that decried that school-age children in America seem to be becoming less creative. So although IQs have been going up for the last two decades, at the exact same time, scores on, believe it or not, they're standardized tests of creativity, but scores on creativity tests have actually been declining year after year after year. No one knows why that's happening. No one really has a clue exactly as to why that's happening. There are lots of hypotheses, as you can imagine. But yes, we are seeing that as a phenomenon. You know, again, we truly don't know why. Is that multitasking? Is that, you know, paying too much attention to your cell phone? Is that kind of not going out and playing in the backyard and imagining things on your own? We simply don't know.
It also seems that we, with the kinds of multiple choice standardized testing that we give them and that we focus on, we tell them that there is always one correct answer and everyone should be able to agree on what it is.
That's true. And we have that whole kind of paradigm, again, that frame, that notion in science that there is a right and a wrong answer. I tell my students forever that there is never a right or a wrong answer because scientists, you know, this becomes kind of a philosophic question, but about what is truth. But, you know, science is really all about getting closer to, I would say, clever solutions, getting closer to solutions that are useful, rather than feeling that we absolutely know the truth of something. Because, you know, again, a disruption comes along and it knocks aside all the things that we thought were true previously. So, you know, a lot of the necessity of the mindset in science is simply being open-minded. And, you know, going back to this method that I teach for innovative thinking, people are sometimes very skeptical about this and they say, you know, can you take somebody who's very, very closed-minded, very rigid thinking, and make them a great creator? And the answer is, of course not. But what the method does is it raises all boats. And in the best of all possible worlds, it simply opens people's minds to possibility.
What does that method look like? Can you sort of shorthand it for us?
I can. So as I mentioned previously, it's really about frame shifting or frame breaking. It's really about this kind of elaborate system that we have in our heads of expectations and assumptions. I'll just give you a funny example that I like to use. You go to a restaurant and you order a dish of pasta. The waiter or waitress brings it, sets it nicely on the table. It looks great, nice and steamy hot. And they smile and they say, is there anything else I can get you? And you say, yes, would you mind bringing some Parmesan cheese? They nod and say, go to the kitchen and get it yourself. right? So that's not what you expected,
right?
You have, but what's interesting about that is not only is it shocking in a sense, it's unsettling to the point where you don't know what to do next. You have so kind of jumped out of your normal set of social expectations that you are stymied. And you also have a very visceral reaction of, oh my gosh, this person must be crazy. You know, let me out of here. So again, it's both cognitive and it's emotional. But what I actually teach is that in order to innovate, in order to create, you actually have to do exactly that. You have to break the system of expectations and assumptions. And often that is uncomfortable, shocking, but certainly almost necessarily instantly rejected before it's accepted. So it's so hard to do. It's actually so hard to even know what your expectations and assumptions are. It's what I call the air in the room. You need it to breathe, and yet you're completely unaware that it's there. You're so unaware of those that actually teaching people first to be able to recognize those and then be able to shift out of those requires a whole series of tools. And so I teach this toolbox that really are as literally the wrenches, the hammers, the nails, the whatnot that allow you to systematically get out of that mindset.
It's almost like jumping outside the culture of science altogether.
It's like jumping out of culture, period. It's not just science, but think about this politically. You know, think about, so an example, if I wanted to talk about individuals who have come to this country without appropriate documentation, I could talk about illegal aliens, right? Mm-hmm. And people use that kind of terminology. Or you could talk about economic migrants, or you could talk about, you know, escapees from harsh dictatorship, right? Those would lead you to very, very different notions of what we're talking about and very different emotional expressions. All of those are metaphors for different frames around that concept.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Will in Dallas. Hello, Will.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Dr. Ness. It's a great show. I'm actually a student here in Dallas in the School of Public Health at the UT system, and I have had personally some experience as far as being a researcher and to going through the grant proposal mechanisms. And to keep it succinct, one of my things that I've noticed in 4 years working at NIH and here is that there's this constant pressure to always publish and consistently come out with results. And when you're trying to come up with a groundbreaking creative thought that's, you know, through a grant proposal mechanism, usually there's a high risk, high reward thing, and there's this unrealistic expectation, I believe, of that there won't be failure. And as something that I've become very acquainted with, that failure exists in a lot of molecular biology or even in public health research. And I just kind of wanted to see, I mean, I think this kind of harkens back to what you originally talked about as, you know, ruining careers because there's always this pressure to always publish. But what do you think what are those kind of solutions around that? Just this unrealistic idea that even the most creative thoughts sometimes or creative ideas will, you know, there will be failures and there will be, you know, results that you just can't publish.
Thanks so much for that call,
Will. Yeah, Will, what a great question. Thanks so much. I'm just so delighted to hear students calling, and thanks for that. So absolutely, you could not be more correct. The very first paper that I ever wrote about innovation some years back was called Fear of Failure. So failure is absolutely requisite in more ground-shifting kinds of research. It takes much, much longer to come up with something that's truly transformational. It takes hitting many more walls, failing much more frequently. So you're absolutely right. And this kind of parsed notion that you have to have this constant rate of productivity is absolutely at odds with that. And it does get back to this whole idea of kind of evolutionary versus revolutionary innovation. So you asked me solutions. Yes, there's a great potential solution to that. It's been used by the Howard Hughes Philanthropic Foundation for many, many years. Howard Hughes is a fascinating funding organization, again, a philanthropic, non-federal organization. They have about 330 what are called Howard Hughes investigators around the country that they fund. And their rate of predicting radical success has been extraordinary insofar as they have funded a whole plethora of people that have gone on to win Nobel Prizes, become members of the National Academies of Science. And so they've got a pretty neat system going. What they do is they fund what they call people, not projects. So you get incented for doing, you know, again, specific piecemeal work, individual projects funded by the federal government, individual papers that are products. What Hughes does is it says, we're really uninterested in that. We're really interested in radical transformation. So we are going to stick with that person. We're going to believe, you know, we're going to make good choices. We're going to invest in this person. We're going to stick with them through thick and thin until they come up with that really disruptive idea.
Is it harder to explain the way you're thinking to people who are well established in their scientific careers than it is to sort of get the message across to people who are just starting out?
Well, it's an interesting question. The book is just coming out now. The very, very first copies are just, you know, starting to kind of hit Amazon. And I really don't know the degree to which the book will be accepted or rejected. I talk in the acknowledgments about the fact that I actually gave up the project at two different points when working on it. It took about 3 years to come to fruition. And at two different points, I literally put it down and said, I'm not going to do this because I was so fearful about the potential chastisement from my colleagues, particularly my senior colleagues. And at one point, I literally, you know, walked into dinner one night and said to my wonderful husband, you know, hey, dear, if I pursue this and I publish this and I get, you know, fired, which, by the way, I just want to say if my president is listening to this or hears some broadcast of this, I don't think could happen because I have tenure. But in any case, you know, if something terrible happened to me career-wise as a function of writing this book and disseminating this publicly, you know, could we survive? And he said, you know, he's very supportive. And he said, dear, you know, of course, you do what you think is best.
Roberta B. Ness is Dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health and author of the new book, The Creativity Crisis, Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. Roberta, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.